Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm Ralph, an alcoholic. A little difficult for us to hear over here from the sound system. If you can't hear me, please just raise your hand. I'll try to get closer or further back or whatever is necessary. I'm like Peggy. I am not a speaker. I don't consider myself a speaker. A group this size is a little overwhelming. So I'm also going to pretend I'm talking to... Most of my meetings are small meetings. I'm going to pretend I'm talking to just a few people. And yet, I am very much aware that this whole room is filled with recovering alcoholics, so that it really isn't that overwhelming, because I know and feel that each of you is my friend, and I'm your friend, and that we share a common experience and a common way to go that makes us brothers and sisters in the most profound way that I know about. So I will try to tell you a little bit about myself for a few minutes, and then I'll try to share with you a little bit about how life goes today. On Thursday night, or Thursday, rather, I had my 13th AA birthday. And it feels right to try to tell you a little bit about what 13 years of sobriety on this program has done with and for me. I was born in a suburb of New York City, a place called White Plains, New York. The oldest of five children into a alcoholic home. My father died of alcoholism at a very young age. I don't know if women have the same thing that some men do, and maybe a lot of men in this room, but my father died of alcoholism when he was 49 years old. And I was convinced before I got sober that I was going to die of alcoholism before I was 50 years old. It just was part of my awareness of life. Indeed, even sober, it took a lot to get to 50, because somewhere in me I felt that I didn't have the right to go beyond him. Luckily, I had a few years of sobriety by then, and I was able to get by that birthday. I have two younger brothers who are on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Growing up, all my father's friends and all our social life in the family had to do with drinking. Aunts and uncles for many years having a lot of parties and good times with drink. And then slowly, as the years progressed, one uncle dying in his own vomit, drunk. A friend falling off a roof, apartment house roof, and dying in the snow, freezing to death through alcoholism. Slowly those early years, which felt so exuberant and so alive and so much fun, booze began to take its toll, and things, tragedies and terrible things began to happen. But I was raised in that environment and never knew any other way growing up than to have fun. And when you're a man, you drink, and to have fun, you drink. And so I began drinking very young, in high school, beer with the boys and having a good time, laughs. And it went from there for the next 30 years, almost 30 years. And as the years went by, the drinking took over more and more of my life. In the beginning, it seemed to be to enhance life. It seemed to be what you added to a dance or to a date or to a party or to a trip or to anything to make it more fun, to make it freer, to make it easier, to make it more audacious, whatever. And slowly, ever so slowly, it began not to be an enhancement to what was going on in my life, but it began to be the thing which I did, and all those other things, dates and parties and work and trips and all those other things were very much secondary, became occasions for me to do what I really more and more had to do, drink. The last, I'd say, 10 years of my drinking, I was in a blackout every night, and sometimes twice a day. I was amazed when the first meeting of AA, when I was able to get home without getting drunk and go to bed for the first time in many years, not in a blackout. I was amazed to discover that I lived in a very nice place. I remember going home from the meeting and a little bit surprised that I didn't stop at any bars on the way home that first day, 13 years ago. And I remember going into this bedroom and looking at it, and I literally had not been aware. I'd been in this house maybe a couple of years. And I remember thinking to myself, this is a very nice room. There were some nice English-style little paned windows that opened up. It was a very balmy evening, September 19th, and there was a big avocado tree outside my bedroom window. Two years there, and I hadn't noticed that. It was either moonlight or a streetlight was shining on these wonderful, I don't know if you know avocado, the leaves are big and they're shining. There's something very sensual and delicious about that, those colors. And I remember looking at that. And I remember looking at the door had was like a Mexican white material, stucco, is it? Rounded like an arch, and I said, gee, that's pretty. And I remember getting in bed and feeling, this bed is comfortable, and these sheets are nice and cool. And I went to sleep, and I did not wake up in the middle of the night like that, wondering what I'd done or what I hadn't done or whatever, and wondering if this was it, because my heart was beating so high, and is this it? And half of me hoping that it was it. And that first morning I woke up, and I hadn't had a drink since very early the day before, 24 hours. And this was the first time in many, many years that I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't figure it out. I remember those first few days and those first few weeks, I didn't want... It was a little bit like... It was like a happy opposite of walking through a graveyard late at night, when you just don't want to breathe too much or move too fast because something might get you. And all I was feeling... I could not understand what was happening to me. Why wasn't I drinking? Because for years and years and years, I had said to myself every day that I wasn't going to drink today. I lived on the top of the hill, and I'd go to work down a hill, over about a mile and into the studio. And at the bottom of that hill, about three blocks over, was a bar called O'Brien's in Los Angeles. And I'd start every morning for years saying, today I'm not at 6 o'clock, I'm not going to drink. Maybe tonight, but not today. I'm just not going to do it. And I'd be absolutely, my willpower would be at its, everything I could muster. I mean, I really meant it. And I'd start down that hill, absolutely convinced, absolutely determined that I was not going to drink. And like those three-minute egg sand things, you know, you turn over. As I went down the hill, and the sand drips down into the bottom thing, as I went down the hill, I could feel, I could almost literally feel the will and the commitment to not drink drain, so that by the time I got to the bottom of the hill and turned right, I never got past O'Brien's. That was maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes. Now that is, to say the least, demoralizing over weeks and months and years. Because what happened to me, of course, is that I just felt such self-loathing, because I really meant that I wasn't going to do these things. And I kept doing them over and over and over and over again, interminably, and I could not stop. And here I was, stopped. A day, 2 days, 3 days. And so I went through those early days not wanting to even think about what was happening, because if I started thinking about it, it might, something might happen. I didn't want to move too fast. I walked rather slowly, and I drove slowly, and I talked slowly. I just didn't want anything to come along. Just let me leave everything alone and keep going and see what happens, because I can't believe this is happening. About 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks into sobriety, I thought maybe I ought to start doing something about this. I mean, they keep saying get a book and read it, and there's steps and things, and so I did, and I saw a step that said amends, and that made sense to me. Not the first few, but the amends step, I could understand that, and first thing I did was I had destroyed a family, an earlier marriage with some children, and in those years of drinking, my in-laws had supported and taken care of my children and my then wife many, many times when I would spend whatever money I had on booze, and I felt immensely grateful, a lot of guilt. But one of the first amend I made was to call my ex-mother-in-law, who was really a very special person, is a very special person, and said, I'm now in a program recovering from my alcoholism, and I want to make an amend, and I want to do this by telling her how much I appreciate everything you've done over the years, and I want to make it up in some small way. I want to send you a check, almost symbolic of what you've done over these many years. And so I did. And about a week later, I called her and said, did you receive the check? She said, yes, I put it in the bank, and it bounced. So I made some other arrangement with her to make an amend. And the second amend I made was, and this is what shape I was in those early few weeks, and was to go to my favorite bartender and pay off my bar tab. That was really smart. I was really in tune with the program. So I went to this bar about 2.5 weeks sober, and I walked in to pay off, to get the slate clean, start a new life. And as I walked in, the bartender said, where the hell have you been? And he brought out the vodka and poured it into the rock glass. And I knew as he did that I was there to drink, not to pay off a bar tab or make an amend. I knew that I was totally unaware until that moment of why I was there. I thought I was there because I was practicing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I knew at that moment that I was there to have a drink, and that there's no way I was going to get out of that place without drinking that drink. It And I stood there at the bar, looking at it, and I didn't pick it up just then. I couldn't leave the bar, so I went the other way. I went into the men's room, and I stood in the men's room, and I prayed. The only thing that came to me, it was only a very few days sober, was people like you, for many meetings now, have looked at me like you're looking at me now, affirming, supportive, loving. And although I've been out in that world and trying to destroy my life for lo these many years, something got through in those few meetings. And all I could say to myself was, I can't handle this. This is way beyond me. I am in way over my head at this moment. But there was enough memory, there was enough power left from those few meetings that you had given me to say, don't do this. Don't drink because you're going to die or none of that stuff. Don't let go of what you've gotten so far from those people. There was some sort of a connection had developed already. And it allowed me to leave that men's room and just grit my teeth and walk right past the bartender, right past the drink, and out to the, and literally, and believe me, I had no way to do this, out to the sidewalk, and as soon as I hit the sidewalk, it lifted, and it was over. I almost became one of those fundamentalists that believes in the devil. It almost was like somebody in me was saying, damn, we almost had him. It almost got where I personalized this destructive force that's in me, and I guess in the world too, and in you. This anti-life force, this inability to respond to goodness and truth and love. But it stopped. It lifted. It didn't go away. I'm sure whoever that person is, part me, part devil, whatever it is still lurking there saying, this guy's turned out to be tougher than we thought. But, let him, you know, so he'll get busy. Maybe he'll miss the meetings, or maybe he'll get a little too ambitious or too many expectations. Or let's keep an eye on him, because one of these days we'll grab him, you know. I don't know how I got to AA. I don't know why I went to that first meeting. One of the things that was happening in my life at that time was I had started on this show called The Waltons, and I was playing this father of all these children. Now, I had been, for years, a New York actor, that is, an actor who felt that poetry and bizarre behavior were almost identical. Who felt that a true artist was crazy and must live the life of drink and song and dance and that's what an artist was. And I had nowhere in my plan had I ever thought that I was going to be on a television series playing a responsible, loving, concerned, and considerate, gentle man. I was in the bars, chasing the broads. I considered myself a warrior. Life is a battle, and I'm going to win it. You know, I mean, those are the kinds of images I had of myself. A pioneer, a wastrel, a poet, a soldier in the fight for truth and beauty. And here I was showing up in this tacky stage with all these kids. And I couldn't go on. I was drunk those first few weeks of that show. I would stop at O'Brien's, and then I would go in, and the guy who was prop man was a friend of mine, a good drinker. He'd mix a quart of vodka and a quart of grapefruit juice with some ice, and all day I'd hold out my hand, and he'd have it there for me. Now, there's something in me that I had children, and there's a part of me that is a loving, responsible, concerned, considerate, gentle person, like in all of us. Now, that person was almost dead, I guess. I certainly hadn't let him out in a lot of years, hadn't given him any room or any air to breathe or nurtured him at all, but he must have been there because something in me loved the show. But the me that was most alive couldn't believe that this was going on and didn't know what he was doing, didn't know why I was here, didn't know why these idiots at the front office didn't fire me. I saw myself on the screen after the first few days, dailies, and that guy looks like the town drunk. He's a bloated face with haunted eyes, no spirit in him, no joy in him, there's nothing. There's a dead, fleshy person up there with dead eyes. Why don't these people get smart and fire me? What's wrong with these people? They're spending a lot of money on this show. Now, maybe I was seeing more than was there, but they didn't fire me. And as the weeks went by, I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand running over the prop and downing a drink and then going and taking little Elizabeth and putting her on my lap and saying, honey, you know, the raccoon, you have to study or the raccoon is sick or whatever those... There's a part of me that just thought this is ludicrous. But there was another part of me that felt touched by these scenes and by these words and by this family trying to caring for each other and shepherding each other through life and strengthening each other for life. There's something very touching about it. And I couldn't do both. It must be that I couldn't hold that tension together. I couldn't feel like this crazy, sick, drunk, and at the same time play for 10, 12 hours a day, this kind, gentle, responsible man. There must have been enough honesty left in me, and if there's anything that alcoholics have, it's some sort of honesty somewhere down deep that may be smothered and maybe warped, but it's there, and I couldn't hold the two together, and thank God the crazy man went, and there was enough attraction here, and enough sense that, don't destroy this, that I somehow got to an AA meeting. I mean, it was all very vague, believe me, and I didn't get to an AA meeting to stop drinking, and I didn't get to an AA meeting to have a good life. I didn't get to AA to become a better person. I didn't get to AA any other reason except I could not stand another day of what I was doing. And these kids and his words and these, all of it was driving me crazy. And I either had to quit or do something. And I didn't know what to do, so I sat in an AA meeting, didn't have any idea that it was going to have any, didn't have any idea what I wanted there, except I couldn't stand another moment. And I went home that night, and I got in bed, and I went to sleep, and I got up, and I'm the next, and I couldn't believe it. And now 13 years have passed. When I go to, I'm short, long shirt.
Long as you want.
No, we're not going to see that. 10 more minutes, 15 minutes.
Got an hour for the...
10 minutes. So I got 10 minutes to tell you about today. No, I mean, you know, I could take 1 second and say 13 years of sobriety is a miracle, and my life is a miracle, and I'm alive, and I'm full of gratitude. And I'm a man that should be dead, should have died when my father died or before, was doing everything I possibly could to bring that about. There's no way I could be alive. 13 years. I got here when I was 44. 57 years old to be alive in my family. You don't do that in my family. And not only to be alive, but to be grateful for each day. I just want to take a couple of minutes to talk about that destructive thing. It's come to my mind a lot lately because I found myself waking up in the last few weeks and months with a lot of discontent and a lot of anxiety. Not a lot, but more than I'd had for a while. And I don't know what I want to say about this, but it's fascinated me. This sickness we have, this demand we have that, I don't know, that reality isn't enough or what, that comes back if we're not careful. I'm shocked and astounded that it persists in me. I've seen people with a lot less time than I have doing a lot better in terms of a positive, daily, comfortable, peaceful life. I've been having a bit of a tough time lately, and I'm not quite sure why, because at the same time my days are filled with gratitude, and the part of me that wants to be sober and loves being sober, which is every year a larger and larger part of me, has good days. But there's still that there. You know, I don't know what's going to happen in years. Why it's taken 13 years to get to the point where I don't give much attention to that negative self. For many years, I thought that negative self, that self that evaluated and judged me, and it was never enough. And I was never really comfortable. And I had no right to be comfortable. And there was these vague shadows and ghosts and thoughts and everything from the past. Things I'd done, things I'd been told as a kid, all that past still imposed on me and turned me negative and made me restless and made me anxious. And it's still there. But no longer do I give it that much attention. No longer do I take it that seriously, and yet it's still there. There was a guy down in the desert where I spent a lot of time, and maybe it's this quality. Maybe he was pointing to the same quality that I've been feeling. He came to this meeting, and he was in wrinkled clothes, to say the least. They were hand-me-downs. And he had driven up, I'd noticed, in an old, beat-up Chevy. I mean, just about making it into the parking lot at the meeting, 7 o'clock morning meeting. And he came in, he sat down, and it was a roundtable thing, and he said, you know, a few years ago, I was a waiter up at Chasen's in Los Angeles, making good money. And I had me a beautiful wife, a loving wife. And a brand new car. And everything was good. And one day I'm riding down the street in the sunlight in my brand new car with lots of money in my pocket and my beautiful wife waiting at home. And this thought popped into my head. You know what, Charlie? This plot is not thick enough. So I began to figure out how I could make things better or worse or whatever. For some reason, it just wasn't. Nothing was happening. I had to do something. And so I'm working over at Denny's. Just about got enough money to get clothes at the Salvation Army and just enough to get gas to get from here to work. Slowly, I'm trying to learn that I don't have to continually get in there and thicken the plot up. All I got to do is show up for meetings and let God go to work in my life. But that quality in him, reminds me of that quality in me. It's like, I was talking to Linda, my wife, about it lately. It's like there's a child in me that has a tantrum. And maybe it's the drunk part of me. I don't know. I can't intellectualize it, and I'm not good at psychology. But there's like a thing in me that wants to mess things up. Much less powerful than before, but still there. And I'm going through a transition period in my life at 57. The work I've been doing for years has begun to not interest me as much and not be offered to me as much, which is a happy coincidence. I'm not sure which came first. I have been going through a big readjustment. I'm in a business where youth and beauty is idolized, and when you get past, for women, unfortunately, it's about 20 in Hollywood. For men, it's, you know, in their 40s, but you tend then to the concentration, and the energy goes toward the young and the beautiful. And I've been going through an adjustment in terms of work, and I've been going through an adjustment in terms of what I want to do and what I'm capable of doing and how I can shift and do things that might mean more to me than some of the work has meant lately. I've been going through a deeper understanding of what marriage and love is, and been very grateful for that. But changes have been coming down, and there's still that negativity, that destructiveness that can pop up and make me discontent or be like the guy who says, this plot is not thick enough, let me get up and let me see what I can do here. I have enough sobriety. 13 years has meant that a few years ago I might have really tried to thicken up this plot. But now I'm not only able to sit still and to find out where I'm to go and to not take these thoughts seriously, but in the midst of this also to be very grateful and to know that that is the truth of my life, that my sobriety and my program and you folks and my higher power is not only my life, but it's a good life. I'm hoping someday, and I don't know if it'll ever happen, that this child, which I suspect underneath is a happy child, wanted life, and somewhere along the line, whatever the sickness is and whatever happens to us as we go along those early years and later, gets warped and gets turned and makes us angry and makes us tyrants, and we want what we want when we want it, and all those things that we do when we get into those negative places and can't stand it, and I don't want it, and I, you know, just riding along and everything's perfect, and all of a sudden you have this thought, I want out, you know. I mean, Dostoevsky has a short story about, that's a human quality maybe in all not just alcoholics, about the old sea captain, and the world was finally made perfect, and everybody had enough to eat, and everybody had good clothes, and everybody was healthy, and the sun shone, and there was plenty of water for the crops, and life was heaven on earth. And this old sea captain stood up and looked around and said, what do you say, mates? Let's tear it down. So maybe it's part of the human condition, but certainly that quality is intensified in me and in alcoholics, I think. You know, the old story about you walk out of the house in the morning, and if you have a flat tire, the ordinary person calls for the automobile club, and the alcoholic calls suicide prevention. We intensified, and we tend to intensify and dramatize our lives. But I'm hoping that as the years go by, and this process has been a slow process, so that my life is based on gratitude now, and is happy to be alive, and happy to be a member of AA, and happy to be a member of the community, and make my contribution in whatever way I can, that this child that has been somehow misshapen by whatever early experiences from fathers, and childhood, and drink, and all the stuff that this child is wants, and whatever this other me in me does, the negative me, the destructive me, maybe underneath that is even just a child who wants to be able to have a little attention and to have a little fun and to not impose too many rules and regulations, not get too heavy in sobriety, that I have to, you know, not get too good. That maybe there's two selves, the sober, responsible, and glad for responsibilities, and glad to be working, and glad to be a grown-up member of society and of AA. That's what I've learned in 13 years, how to do a little bit of that. But this child also can maybe come together with this adult into the real Ralph. And I sense that from friends and being around AA that there are two selves in a lot of us, the one that's sober and the other one that keeps sticking its head out. And then maybe as the years go by, I feel that the process of sobriety helps us to become one person that can be have fun and be silly and be joyous and dance and sing and also take care of business and show up and do our jobs. And those two can be one in one integrated person. When I got here 13 years ago, I was a fractured person without any spirit left in me. I used to be in religious work many years ago, and I remember in the Bible, one of the great phrases was, I see a new heaven and a new earth. And believe me, I have sensed that in sobriety, that the old earth and the old heaven, full of despair and a dark and colorless place, slowly has become a new heaven and a new earth because of the love and power and beauty that somehow works through and in this program. I am really glad to be among you tonight, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.